Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I am so excited to tell you that What Matters, our 2024-2025 season registration, is now open. If you don't know, What Matters is a 28-week class that we think of as our version of divinity school. Having gone to divinity school, I was like, everyone should get to do this. Everyone should get to have a dedicated season to thinking about what matters to them and how they can live up to their values. And we have tried to condense that experience into half a year while still making it spacious enough that there's time, but also not making you quit your job and go to school for 3 years. It's facilitated by me, my friends Mauricio Bruce and Michaela Bly. Mauricio is a brilliant chaplain and therapist. Michaela is a Grand Slam winning storyteller. The program is divided into 3 units, each focused on a different novel. You also get one-on-one chaplaincy time. You get small group time. It's an incredibly special, small class. Our next cohort begins August 21st and will run through March 12th. Payment plans and scholarships are available. Go to notsorryworks.com to reserve your spot today.
Chapter 17, Cat, Rat, and Dog. Harry's mind had gone blank with shock. The three of them stood transfixed with horror under the invisibility cloak. The very last rays of the setting sun were casting a bloody light over the long shadowed grounds. Then, behind them, they heard a wild howling. I'm Matt Potts.
And I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text.
So Matt, for this week's Every Flavored Bean, I would love to tell you a story because I met your Patronus.
You met my Patronus?
I did, Matt. I met Max. And so I'm going to tell you all about meeting Max in Yellowstone. And Great. We are going to share stories about, there's so many animals that are met in this chapter. We're going to tell some stories about encountering exciting animals.
I love it. Can't wait. I love animals.
I know. Me too. And everybody, we just want to offer a trigger warning before we jump into today's episode. We are recording this the week of the shooting at Robb Elementary School and the week after the shooting in Buffalo, and just in a culture of the world in which people are getting shot all the time, especially children in schools. And it was impossible for Matt and I to carry that and not read that into the chapter. So we will be talking about that in this week's episode. And so we want to warn you, if that is not something that you feel like listening to today, we totally understand. And we'll talk to you next week.
Vanessa, our theme this week is partnership. So what story do you have for us, partner?
This was so fun to think about because I realized that I think of so many people as my partners in various parts of my life. And I'm going to tell a story today about one of my favorite people, my friend Dana Greer. Dana and I worked together for 7 years at an education nonprofit in New York. And she and I had very similar jobs. We were together constantly. We traveled all over the country together. We were very close and still are very close. I talked to her weekly at least. And I've told this beginning part of the story on the podcast before. I was almost as low at this organization that you could get. And my boss, Mike, picked me up and shook me and yelled at me in front of other people one day. And I couldn't really get it together after. He then mocked me and tousled my hair. And I started crying for hours. I like literally couldn't catch my breath. And Dana was there and she was very sweet and very understanding. And I was sent home because I was embarrassing Michael. And I decided that everyone sort of allowed a bad day and that I wasn't going to report it to HR. And so the story that I'm telling today actually takes place the following day. And so the following day, I wake up in the morning and I'm going to go to work and I'm going to be fine, I've decided. And it was my job. We were running a conference and it was my job to sit in the back of this conference breakout room and make sure that everybody had everything they needed. If the faculty needed help with anything, technology-wise, someone forgot a pen, that was my job in this room, is just to sit there and make sure everything ran smoothly. And so I'm setting up the room and I get a call from Dana, and Dana says, take attendance in your session today. And I was like, that's why? Like, that is not one of the things we do. We don't take attendance. This is an optional conference. Like, there's nothing to take attendance for. And she was like, I just overheard Michael Moore saying to my boss, to Dana's boss, Dreema, that if you don't take attendance today, he's going to fire you. And I was like, what? Okay. And she was like, I can't really talk. We'll talk later. She hung up. I took attendance. Michael came to this session to sort of supervise me, and he was clearly frustrated that I was taking attendance. And it was while sitting in the back of the room at that session that I was like, oh, I have to report this to HR. This man is embarrassed by the way that he treated me and is going to try to find an excuse to fire me. And it was because of the information that Dana gave me that I made that decision. Well, as soon as I reported it to HR, Dana got called in by her boss and was reprimanded for telling me what she had overheard. And I was on the other side of the door, so I overheard the conversation in which Dana said, first of all, Mike said this in front of me, and so if he didn't want me to know, he shouldn't have said it within earshot. Second of all, and this is the key thing, my loyalty is to Vanessa, not to Mike. And that was it. And this had all sorts of consequences. Dana and I essentially got sent to the Siberia of the organization and were pushed out. And I can't tell you, obviously, this won't surprise anyone, how much that meant to me. That A, that Dana told me, because otherwise I would have been blindsided and it would have looked retaliatory that I was reporting it to HR, right? Like, her calling me really saved me. And then that when she was getting in trouble, rather than, you know, backpedaling it at all, saying my loyalty is to Vanessa. And Dana's a political person, so I think her loyalty would have been to anyone sort of in an equal position rather than a position of power. But part of it was because of our closeness. And that to me is what partnership is. Partnership is about a series of promises and commitments, but it only becomes truly a partnership to me when you're willing to risk something. And that was a moment to me in which Dana was clearly willing to risk a lot for me. And I guess maybe that's not a necessary component of a partnership, but it is the component that makes it clear to me that it is a meaningful partnership.
That's a really interesting definition, Vanessa, like, because like there are all kinds of like forms of like working together, right? But
right.
What you've indicated is unique about partnership is that there's a deeper kind of loyalty. Like there's more at stake. And more put at risk, like you said, right? Like there's all kinds of ways that people work together, but you can work with someone or even support someone without actually putting yourself on the line. But what Dana did for you was really like put herself on the line, and that signals something deeper, a more committed sort of loyalty, which, yeah, partnership seems like a pretty good name for.
And we definitely see that partnership in the trio to just like the nth degree in this chapter, right?
Yeah.
Well, Matt, partner in 30-second recap and so many other things. Are you ready to offer your 30-second recap?
I feel like today of all days, I'm just going to say what I can say in 30 seconds and you will risk your own 30 seconds.
I will.
You will risk the excellence of your own 30 seconds to fix mine. And that's why this is a true partnership.
Okay, Matt, on your mark, get set, go.
So they're walking away from Hagrid's hut, and they're very upset, and they can't believe what just happened. And then Crookshanks shows up, and Crookshanks attacking, and then Scabbers, and the dog comes, and the dog grabs Ron and takes Ron to the tree, and Ron's leg is broken, and they go in the tree, and Crookshanks says, "Here's how you get in the tree," and pushes the thing, and everything stops beating everybody up, and they go in, and they follow, and they get to the Shrieking Shack, and they go upstairs, and Ron's there, and Sirius Black is there, and Lupin's there, and it's not what they think, and Harry almost kills him, but he doesn't. Oh my gosh, that boy.
And it's not what they think.
Boy, I ran out of time really quickly in that. I I thought I'd spend a lot of time just reflecting upon the moral decision that Harry was faced with in that moment. It turns out 30 seconds is not enough time to really reflect upon that. Or...
No.
Or is it, partner?
Is it? Well, we'll see.
Okay. Are you ready, Vanessa?
I am.
3, 2, 1, go.
So I think what's appropriate is for us to reflect on the moral decision that Harry has to make here. And that is whether or not he should kill Sirius Black. This is the man who he thinks is responsible for killing his parents. This is the man who stabbed the fat lady and who slashed at Ron's sheets. This is a violent man who was willing to kill 7 people just to make his own escape. And Harry now has the chance for that revenge. And so he is looking at Sirius and he is deciding whether or not to go for the attack. And he just can't get himself to do it.
Because of Crookshanks? Is it because of Crookshanks? It might be because of Crookshanks.
Matt, I would like to start this conversation with something I wrote down, which is these poor children. These kids have just overheard a beloved animal have its head chopped off. And then the trauma just like keeps on coming. Ron gets like violently pulled into the Whomping Willow. There is a thunderous crack, which is the sound of his leg breaking. And then Hermione and Harry get beat up on their way into following Ron. They are then in a terrifying situation with who they believe to be a convicted murderer. Harry has to confront the death of his parents while Ron and Hermione are afraid that their best friend is about to get killed. They're 13.
This is terrible. This was, I did not like reading this chapter, honestly. As you said at the top of the episode, the shooting in Uvalde just happened. And just this week, I'm sure listeners will know more by the time this episode is released, but, you know, details of what children in the room were doing, how they were trying to protect each other and actions they were taking. Having to read about these 13-year-olds being heroic is not what I wanted to read this week, right? Like, it just, it didn't feel like fiction. You know, like, by the end of the series, I like Sirius Black. He seems like a good guy. And, like, he broke Ron's leg. He's putting all these folks at risk. At best, he wants to murder somebody in front of them. At best.
Yeah.
Right? Like, just the whole thing, just, it was hard to read. I mean, everything's hard to do these days, I think, honestly, in the wake of the shooting. But reading this and reading how this chapter kind of glorifies the heroism of these children. And it does. I mean, around their partnership. I mean, they show the kind of loyalty that you described as constituting partnership. And I think described well in your story, right? But like they risk for each other. Like they chase after Ron and go into the Whomping Willow because he's at risk. They go into the Shrieking Shack. Harry and Ron and Hermione fight Sirius Black and get the wands away. Like they are willing to be heroic in that Gryffindor way. And maybe it's my own fault, but 2 weeks ago, I think reading this, I would have been like, oh, this is a story and these are these kids and this is Harry Potter. And this week, it just feels, I don't want to see children put in that situation ever. And even seeing them put in this situation fictionally in this chapter just felt hard to read.
Yeah. And, you know, we've spent so much time this season talking about the structural failures that means that these fights land on the shoulders of these kids. And Lupin shows up, but why didn't Lupin alert Dumbledore, right? Like, again, there's just this irresponsible lack of thought on behalf of the adults in this chapter that, again, just seems so reminiscent of the world that we're living in with, you know, Ted Cruz being unwilling to admit that guns are the problem in this situation and, in fact, attempting to make schools even more dangerous by wanting to make it so there's only one egress in and out of a school, which would be a nightmare in the case of a fire. And so it, again, just like feels so reminiscent. And I think what's troubling about it is that I think I would feel okay about this representation that feels so apt if I felt as though the book was knowingly condemning these teachers and showing the way that the trauma realistically impacts the kids. But it does. It feels like it's glorifying the kids' heroism when really these kinds of partnerships shouldn't have to exist.
I think that's right. But I think, you know, I've been thinking about this since I was reading this. And I think that maybe we need to read the books a different way. I'm not trying to be an apologist for J.K. Rowling, who is not someone I want to apologize for. But I wonder if it makes sense to apologize for the text itself which is not intended for adults like you and me. It's actually intended for 13-year-olds. And maybe, you know, in 1996, there was an awful mass shooting at an elementary school in Stirling, Scotland. I think 16 children were killed in that shooting. And then, you know, about a year later, this the first of the Harry Potter series is released. And it's not, it wasn't written for grown-ups. It was written for kids. And I wonder if it's written for young people, for 13-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds who have seen that adults are not protecting them. And so the story that is given to these people who should not have to be heroes is, maybe we can be heroes. What would it look like if we would save ourselves instead of adults saving us? And when I think about it that way, then you're right, adults should be taking care of them. But the manifest fact is that in this country, at least, adults are not taking care of them. So if children want to read books where they are strong enough to take care of themselves, I get it, man. Like, I understand, right? I mean, if this is the fantasy that is more believable than the reality, that children can be heroes and save themselves from the evil around them, maybe this is why the book speaks to young people.
I'm really grateful for that reframe for its own sake, but also because it invites me to read the text in a different way, which is, I'm one of the adults now, right? When I first read these books, I was 18, 19, 20. And so I was older than the kids, but I was definitely closer to the kids' age than like a Dumbledore. And now it's actually really helpful to see myself reflected in a Lupin. How many times do I fly into a situation assuming that I'm enough when really what I should be doing is ringing alarm bells loudly? How many times have I failed children in this exact way, threatened or done something inappropriate in front of one of them, or not taken enough care about how I do something because there is a child present? And so I think that the call is to see myself in these incredibly flawed adults and learn from them.
Yeah. I also think the way you initially framed it, I think, is really important, too, because even if we do read these stories as fantasies of child heroism that are understandably appealing to children who are at risk, the texts also do glorify individual heroism, like Lupin will come and save them, or whoever will come and save them, rather than like change the system. Right.
Yeah.
And what did happen in the UK and what has happened in many other places, Australia and New Zealand and other places, is that systems were changed. But the heroism which is lacking in our country is this refusal to even entertain the question of subtly shifting the most minor aspects of the system. And also the solutions that are lifted up as alternatives to systemic change usually have something to do with, oh, we need more people to be heroic. We need more people to act like fantasy heroes to prevent this kind of violence, when the actual policy solutions are incredibly straightforward and known and just not done.
Well, and what's so interesting to make this about partnership again, Matt, is that partnership is, to a large extent, about not being self-serving, about saying, in this space, in this capacity, I consider your body to be part of my body. We are the same right now, right? And Harry, Ron, and Hermione all do that for one another again and again in this chapter. They're saying, if you hurt Ron, you're hurting me. If you're hurting Harry, you're hurting me. And I don't know what it is, but I see that as more possible for children than for adults. And I guess kids, to some extent, have less complicated or less nuanced things to risk, right? Like, they have their whole lives to risk, but it's not like, you know, Dumbledore has to think about keeping Hogwarts open and having a good relationship with the Ministry of Magic, and right? Whereas to kids, there's just this clarity of Dementors are bad and shouldn't be on campus. And so I guess the thing that this is making me think about with partnership is, which partnership do you want to prioritize? And I would say that Dumbledore's allegiance should be with the children. And instead, he has this complex web of partnerships that I can imagine him justifying as being in service of the children. But I think it misses the point.
Well, I think that one of the things that partnership assumes is that I am not sufficient to the task by myself, right? I mean, in some ways, there is heroism in this chapter. We've been talking about heroism, but after Ron gets his leg broken by Sirius Black in dog form and taken under the Whomping Willow and out to the Shrieking Shack, you know, Harry and Hermione chase after him. It is selfless, but it's also because they know that Ron can't do it by himself, right? It's this awareness that this kind of individual heroism is insufficient, and that's why they chase after him, right? And they get the Shrieking Shack, and Sirius Black is in his person form, right? And they're struggling over the wands or whatever. Like, Hermione just kicks Sirius, right? Like, kicks Sirius and helps Harry battle him and wrestle him. And Ron with his broken leg does too, despite all the pain. And again, it's because, like, they know that Harry, as much as a hero as he has been, can't do this on his own, right? And it seems like what haunts so much of the rest of, especially the adults' ideology in this book, is the idea that one person can fix this, right? And that's even what is put on Harry from the beginning of the series. Mm-hmm. Like, you are the hero, one person can fix it. But what Harry comes to realize in this book and in each book progressively and at the end of the whole series is that, you know, the boy who lived is the community that forms around him and resists evil. It's not just him on his own. And so the beauty of the partnerships in this chapter and the fact that they are centered upon children, I think maybe one thing that children realize is that they're vulnerable. They know they're vulnerable because they're children. And if you know you're vulnerable, then you know you need help. And you also know that your friends who are also vulnerable need help. And so you help, right? And you work together and you don't expect the other person to be a hero. And, you know, returning it to Robb Elementary School, what we see are children from these rooms who are at risk making phone calls and taking risks to try to help their classmates in those rooms. And then adults being cautious and waiting for heroes to show up and not doing enough to save the children in those rooms, and legislators and all those other people not doing enough. So, I mean, again, like, I see these books as speaking to children who feel that adults do not keep them safe. And the answer they have is that, well, we need to keep each other safe. There is not one single child hero, superhero who's going to save us all. We need to save each other. And I think that is where the partnerships we see in this chapter show up. It's what's really beautiful about them.
A moment that reminds me of, Matt, is when Harry and Hermione make it into the Shrieking Shack and see that it's Sirius. Sirius says to them, I knew that you would come after your friend, and it was very brave of you to not call for help. And, right, like, that's an adult mindset, as you laid it out, of, like, good for you, you could do it alone. And then Hermione hears someone below, and she's like, I don't care what you think. Help! Help! We're out here! Right. And she's like, we didn't not call for help because we thought we could do it alone or because we were brave. We didn't call for help because of strategy. Like, it was too short a period of time. You were dragging Ron in. And so I love her rejection, like, our brave Gryffindor Hermione. Yeah. When Sirius is like, good for you for thinking you can do it alone. She's like, nah-uh.
God, now that you mention that, Vanessa, that's so smart. And actually, it points right to, like, the origin story of the whole series, which is, you know, Sirius and the Fidelius charm and him thinking that he could protect this family on his own because of that charm.
Right. And then him feeling, so the Fidelius charm being the secret keeper charm, right? That as long as one person knows where James and Lily and Harry are, nobody else can find out. And so the only way for people to be able to find them is that the secret keeper would have to tell. And Sirius, we don't know why, but Sirius hands that responsibility over to Peter Pettigrew. And maybe it was actually out of humility of, like, I can't do this, right? Like, you do this. But it's a dumb charm because two people should each know half or something. Yeah. And it's that isolation of Sirius being like, whatever it is, right? Like, Voldemort will come torture me because of my brother Remus, right? Like, I guarantee you Sirius had a really good reason for handing that over to Peter Pettigrew. Yeah. And yet we know that just entirely backfires.
I mean, you compare that, these two versions of defending Harry. When he's 1 year old, the adults decide to defend him by making it secret and putting a hero in charge of it and hoping that that keeps the rising tide of evil away from him. And then, you know, whatever, 18 years or 17 years and 7 novels later, the children do it by building an army around him and standing up together, right? It really is like a public shared burden among all the folks who resist rather than a private kind of secret charm, an individual charm that tries to protect Harry. Yeah. You know, the word, we got to make our visit to Etymology Corner, the word partnership. It's actually really interesting, and there is some stuff to reflect upon it, I think, with respect to our chapter and some of the things we've been saying. The first part of the word partnership, partner, comes from the Latin partitio, which just means a share or a portion. Right. And so implied in the idea of partnership is like, oh, we have a task that we all have to share. Like, we can't actually hold this. You know, it's like when you're carrying a couch up the stairs, right? Like, we each need to hold a corner. It doesn't work. It's too big for any one of us. We each need to hold a corner to get it up the stairs. But the other part, the ship part, shows up in lots of words, craftsmanship or marksmanship or whatever. That comes from an old Germanic root that means like almost like whittling, to like to shape or to craft, like something needs to be honed and carved and crafted. And it makes me think about, you know, we're in the third book now. And Harry and Ron and Hermione have been doing this with each other for years. And sometimes it's gone well, like it did, you know, at the end of book two. And sometimes it has gone poorly, like earlier in this book when they were not very nice to Hermione. But they are practiced at leaning on each other. Right. And the idea that partnership is a practice, that sharing your portion means being in relationship with each other, giving to others and receiving from others and letting others take their share of the burden and then picking up the share of the of others' burden. I mean, we just talked about this in the last chapter. You can see Ron and Hermione coming back into this balance and like learning to carry each other again in an important way. And we see it here as well in this really climactic fight scene in the Shrieking Shack, that these three are there for each other, but it didn't just come out of nowhere. They've been practicing this, they've been honing this craft, and they've been figuring out how to carry one another's burdens for a few years, and they're going to keep getting better at it and keep being tested in this way for several books to come.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This week's episode of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text is brought to you by MeUndies. Vanessa, my underwear drawer is like the Wild West of wardrobes.
Say more, Matt.
There's no rhyme or reason. Anything goes. I get gifts for like Christmas. There are seasonal underpants and socks. I have pairs from five different brands with five different fits. When I open my underwear drawer every morning, I have no idea what to expect. But I'll tell you what the best part of my underwear drawer is, Vanessa. It's the buttery soft comfort of MeUndies. When I open that underwear drawer, they're always what I reach for first. I know it's time to do the laundry when my unfavorite underwear is all that's left in the drawer.
Matt, my MeUndies underwear is my favorite underwear too. I actually have to do laundry today because I am wearing my last pair of clean MeUndies underwear. From black classics to fun, expressive prints, MeUndies has a look for everyone, and they come in sizes extra small to 4XL, guaranteeing a flattering cut for every body. They also, and this is what I love about them, have unmatched comfort. MeUndies' signature fabric is as soft as a warm hug from your favorite sweater. It's breathable and stretchy and oh so comfy, making it ideal for all day wear. Get 20% off of your first order plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/HPST. That's MeUndies.com/HPST for 20% off plus free shipping. MeUndies, comfort from the outside in. Matt, another moment where you see like a lack of partnership is when Hermione lets us know that she essentially figured out that Lupin was a werewolf from Snape's assignment that he gave to the kids on like the history of the werewolf and what a werewolf is. And what is clear from that is that Snape is not a full partner to Lupin, right? Snape is willing to make the Wolfbane potion for Lupin. He's even willing to bring the Wolfbane potion to Lupin and kind of be a mensch about it. And yet he's not willing to agree with this apparent order from Dumbledore that we're not talking about the fact that Lupin is a werewolf. This is a dangerous world for werewolves. We are a sanctuary for werewolves here. And I, in theory, am like pro people staying open-minded to breaking ranks with authority, right? Like, I don't want everyone to just follow in step. I want people to be thinking for themselves. And yet this does not feel motivated by anything good, right? This isn't, I'm genuinely concerned for the students, so I feel like I have to say something, right? Like, this on Snape's behalf feels like a break in partnership with this order from Dumbledore and with, you know, I would imagine like McGonagall is supportive of Lupin or whoever else, and this break in partnership with Lupin for entirely selfish reasons.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And even worse, he's exploiting the stigma around werewolves in order to break this partnership, right? Because he actually, it seems like he resents Lupin because Lupin's popular, right? It seems like he resents Lupin because the students like him. And that's the thing he's attacking. Like, he's, Dumbledore already knows he's a werewolf. It's not like revealing the fact that Lupin's a werewolf will get Lupin fired. He's actually not trying to damage Lupin professionally with the staff who already know he's a werewolf. He's trying to damage Lupin with the students who he knows will react to the stigma around werewolves and dislike this new popular Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, right? And so it seems like this really petty kind of, I'm going to make these students not like you. I'm going to reduce your popularity. I'm going to make you unhappy here, which is really crummy.
Yeah, when to, like, step in and step out of partnerships is a really interesting question. And I think the Ron and Hermione story arc is really helpful to think through now, because seeing them in this chapter through the theme of partnership makes me believe that they were always partners. They were partners in a fight. And if you would have asked Ron and Hermione, whatever, a month ago, are you friends? I bet they'd be like, no. But if you then were like, well, are you partners? I wonder if that word would have been like, well, yeah, if she needs me, I'll obviously be there for her, but I don't like her.
Yeah.
Right? It's like partner, it is this different thing. And it's, I'll stick with you even when I don't like you. And I'll, it almost feels like there needs to be sort of a formal breakup, and you're going to not let the fact that she turned in a broom be the thing.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, that's not what I was thinking you meant when you said partners in a fight, although everything you said, I think, is right. What I was thinking about when you said partners in a fight was just that, like, they have both decided that the thing they're doing together is fighting. And so, but you know what I mean? Like that,
yes,
and that, right?
Totally.
And that, like, and we are just going to do it. And until it's over, we're just going to fight. And right? Like, and they're totally committed to it because that's what each of them need. They need to be on opposite sides of this thing. And so they're going to keep doing it.
Oh, I love that, because the opposite of love or liking is in hate. It's indifference.
Right.
And neither of them are opting into indifference. They're like, if you're going to be mad at me, I'm going to be mad at you. There's like a matchedness. I love that point.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that your question about, like, when to enter and exit partnerships makes me think of is, like, Crookshanks plays such an interesting role in this chapter. Because when this chapter starts, Crookshanks is partners with two sets of people who are not partners with each other, right? Crookshanks thinks of himself, if we can think of this magic cat as thinking to himself, he thinks of himself as a partner with Hermione and the trio, of course, right?
Yeah.
He also thinks of himself as a partner with Sirius Black. And in this chapter, it is because of Crookshanks that those separate partnerships become combined into a larger partnership, right? Like, they are able to follow Ron and Sirius to the Shrieking Shack because Crookshanks lets them into the Whomping Willow. And, you know, we haven't talked about this yet. We're not sure what Harry would have done, whether he would have killed Sirius Black or not, if Crookshanks had not sat on top of Sirius's chest and given rise to this moment of pause. But Crookshanks does. What we know is there is a moment of pause, and it's one that Crookshanks makes happen, because Crookshanks is like, with his paws, right? Like, it's not a moment of pause from his paws. Like, it's like, no, you are not enemies. You are partners. And I am just going to help you realize that. Like if the ship part of partnership is about crafting, like, that partnership is something that has to be carefully crafted and brought together and molded and shaped, right? Like, that's what Crookshanks has been doing for a few chapters. And the moment of crisis is now, and he is completing the final turns on this beautiful vase of partnership that he has been molding.
And he has an enemy, right? He's also, like, trying to get Scabbers.
That's right. He's breaking a partnership too, right? Because Ron thinks that he and Scabbers are partners, and they're trying to be like, nope, actually, you have different partners. You don't realize.
Okay, Matt, I feel like we have to talk about this Lupin Sirius reunion if we're going to talk about partnership in this. So the line that I'm thinking about is when Hermione has just confronted Lupin and been like, no, you know, I was protecting you, but you've been his friend this whole time. And Lupin goes, I wasn't his friend, but I am now. And it feels like Lupin is admitting I was disloyal to Sirius when I shouldn't have been, and I'm opting back into this partnership. I've realized that he and I were partners all along, and I just didn't know it, but I wasn't a good friend to him, right? Like, he failed as a friend, but they were always on the same side. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Even though they didn't know it?
I think that's a great question and, like, a really interesting formulation because, yeah, I hadn't thought of this before, but you're right. Like, you can totally be at work on the same project without being friends with somebody, right? You can even be thinking you're at odds with each other. Like, Lupin has thought he's been at odds with Black this whole time. Black has realized that they weren't at odds. So they've been actually working together as partners, even though they have been, at least from one direction, enemies. That's really perceptive, Vanessa.
Matt, we are now going to do our sacred practice, and this week we're doing Florilegium. We each pick a sentence that sparkled up to us from the chapter, and we're going to talk about where the sentence comes from, why we picked it, and then we'll put them in conversation with one another. Matt, what sentence did you pick for us this week?
Vanessa, my sentence comes from the very beginning of the chapter when our trio is walking away from Hagrid's hut, and the narrator says that the very last rays of the setting sun were casting a bloody light over the long shadowed grounds.
Ooh.
It's just like a solid sentence, right? Like, this is what fiction's supposed to do, right? Like, it's describing the scene both accurately, right? Because the setting sun is often red. It has like this reddish color to it. And so it's using this. But in describing it as a bloody light, it's also referencing what has just happened in the last chapter. And even this idea of long shadowed grounds, right? Like, that is what happens at dusk. You get long shadows when the sun is setting. But there's also this idea of like this approaching kind of doom, like this growing darkness in the world or whatever, because of Sirius or because of the rise of Voldemort or all these things. And so the sentence both describes literally what's happening in this moment and in an interesting way, but it also kind of figuratively points to other things that are going on in this chapter and in the series. What's your sentence, Vanessa?
My sentence comes from the very end of the chapter.
Ooh.
And the sentence is, he seemed to be holding his breath as he gazed intently at Scabbers. And the sentence is about Lupin. And I love it because I feel like there are two things going on at the same time, at minimum. One is he's holding his breath because he's trying to figure out which of his friends is a murderer, right? Like, a lot hangs in the balance of this, right? If Scabbers is Peter Pettigrew, that is definitive proof that Peter Pettigrew has been there the whole time. This theory that has been percolating in Lupin's head since he saw Peter Pettigrew's name on the Marauder's map is coming to fruition. But the other thing that I think is very funny and poignant is that he's also looking at his friend in like a reunion way and is like looking and being like, Peter Pettigrew is a rat, right? Like, Scabbers all these years ago looked a certain way. And is it him? And that, like, uncanny feeling of, like, is that the person I went to high school with? Oh, or does it just look like him? It's just a very funny visual for a human to be having with a rat. And so the stakes of this are very high, but the image of it is just very amusing.
Yeah, even, like, a person, like, looking intently in the eyes of a rat. Like, that just seems right. Kind of a funny scene, yeah. So we have a line from the beginning and the end of the chapter. It's a Florilegium sandwich.
It is. And now we will put the sentences in conversation with one another. The very last rays of the setting sun were casting a bloody light over the long shadowed grounds. He seemed to be holding his breath as he gazed intently at Scabbers.
Well, what's interesting here for me is that it relocates the scene, right? Like, it draws, now this is happening on the grounds in the setting sun. and all the imagery of the blood red light and the long shadows is placed on this moment of encounter between Lupin and Peter, which is, I mean, it doesn't really expose anything new in terms of the meaning, but it does, through the imagery, kind of raise the stakes and maybe shift the emotional content of that moment for me a little bit, right? Like, it feels like, this is the culmination of 13 years of anguish for Lupin, or 13 years of whatever, like, struggle with this moment in his past. There's something that intensifies the affective content for Lupin, I think.
Yeah, often in fairy tales, right, like, things end at sundown, right? Like, I'm, of course, just thinking of the Disney versions, but, like, the Little Mermaid becomes a mermaid again at sundown, like, when the sun sets, some sort of, like, curse or whatever is over. And so it's, of course, this scene isn't set with the setting sun, because this isn't the end of the adventure, right? We know that in the next few chapters, there's just going to continue to be all this action. But I love the setting sun imagery, to your point, because it is the closing of a moment for Lupin and Scabbers, right? Yeah. Scabbers is finally going to be caught, and Lupin is finally going to have this click into place. And, I mean, when was the last time Peter Pettigrew, Lupin, and Sirius were all in the same place, right? They were such close friends, and they're realizing we're all together. And so I love this reading where the setting sun signifies that, like, a big transition has happened and is ending. This would be enough for a big day, right? Like, if the day ended here, Lupin could go home and be like, I had a wild day.
Yeah, that's right. It also makes me think of Trelawney's prediction in the last chapter, right? This is also the beginning of nighttime, a night that will not, like, dawn will not rise until the end of chapter 7, right? In the next book, Voldemort will physically and materially, somatically, bodily arise because of Peter Pettigrew, and things are going to get a lot darker in the next book. You know, people are going to start to die, not in memory, but in the actual plot of the books. So, like, night is falling, right? Like, that's another thing that's going on, and this is also maybe what Lupin is seeing, even if he doesn't realize he's seeing it in that moment.
I mean, night is falling and the moon is rising, which is going to be the other thing that happens for Lupin, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, should we put these two sentences in another order?
He seemed to be holding his breath as he gazed intently at Scabbers. The very last rays of the setting sun were casting a bloody light over the long shadowed grounds. I feel like this is something he sees, like, in Scabbers, like, reflected in Scabbers' eyes, right?
In his little rat eyes.
Yeah, his beady little eyes. That does have, like, a slightly different semantic feel, right? Because this is, like, Peter is going to be crucial to the rise of Voldemort, obviously, right? As Trelawney has predicted, as we will learn in the next book, the lengthening shadows and the blood-red light, that actually is within Peter. It's in Peter in this moment. So if this formulation makes it look like these things are within the eyes of Peter Pettigrew, then that's also true, because that's where they are. And that's his getting away at the end of this book. It's what's going to allow for everything that's going to happen in the next book, and therefore in the rest of the series to come.
Yeah. It also makes me feel how time sensitive this is. He's trying to figure out, right? He's looking intently at Scabbers, but the last rays of the setting sun are there, right? Like, he doesn't have a lot of time to do this. And that often feels true, that the highest stakes things, you don't have a lot of time to decide, right? Or to figure out. It's like you can be looking for a job for 6 months and then the job gets offered to you and you have until Monday to decide, right? Like, often there's this, like, slow, 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 quick element. Yeah. This has been a dormant question for 12 years, and all of a sudden, Lupin has to decide before the sun sets.
Yeah, right.
Matt, thanks so much. This is so fun.
Thank you. Yeah. These were really sparkly sparklets. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I am so excited to tell you that What Matters, our 2024-2025 season registration, is now open. If you don't know, What Matters is a 28-week class that we think of as our version of divinity school. Having gone to divinity school, I was like, everyone should get to do this. Everyone should get to have a dedicated season to thinking about what matters to them and how they can live up to their values. And we have tried to condense that experience into half a year while still making it spacious enough that there's time, but also not making you quit your job and go to school for 3 years. It's facilitated by me, my friends Mauricio Bruce and Michaela Bly. Mauricio is a brilliant chaplain and therapist. Michaela is a Grand Slam winning storyteller. The program is divided into 3 units, each focused on a different novel. You also get one-on-one chaplaincy time. You get small group time. It's an incredibly special small class. Our next cohort begins August 21st and will run through March 12th. Payment plans and scholarships are available. Go to notsorryworks.com to reserve your spot today. This week's voicemail is from James.
After listening to your recent podcast about Lupin teaching on his first day, I want to bless Lupin, the other Hogwarts teachers, and any new teacher in their system or another school. Teaching is a very difficult profession. I've been at it for 23 years. And blessing for Lupin, because it's really hard to join a profession where you're expected to be perfect your first day and perfect every day after that. So I wanted to bless Lupin and the other new teachers.
James, thank you so much. I'm not sure I have anything to add except that teachers deserve all the blessings.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, James, for all you do and for taking on that impossible task. Because the work's so important.
It is now time for us to remember members of our community who have been loved and lost. Marguerite K. Rube, who is 93, a beloved grandmother, caregiver, and an incredible cook. Holly Theobald, who is 46, a daughter, sister, and best ever friend. Pat Sorensen, 81, who is a great-grandmother and a kind and loving person. Chaya Yaduev, who is 69, a polio survivor, a great friend, and a true tzedakah. Pamela Collette, who is 62, a mom, grandma, sister, and gymnastics royalty. Vanessa Balzano, who was 42. John Sanji, 64, an uncle, husband, father, and grandfather. Courtney Brooke Allen, 31, butterfly, hummingbird, bright light, weaver, tender. Her memory is a blessing. Caleb Comanche, who was 33, a Good Samaritan, killed on the scene of Courtney Brooks' fatal car accident when he stopped to help. Florence Winton Flo Womack, who is 99, a computer for what is now NASA, a draftswoman, and a beloved sister. May their memories be a blessing to us all. Matt, who would you like to bless this week?
Vanessa, you know, we didn't get the chance to spend a lot of time on this scene in the chapter, but Crookshanks crawls on top of Sirius and makes Harry pause for a moment. And I'm not sure if that moment of pause was what kept Harry from killing Sirius, but Crookshanks did it to prevent Harry from killing Sirius. And yeah, Crookshanks in this chapter is so knowing and also like so calm. It seems like maybe it's just because of the way I think about cats, right? I'm as I read this chapter, I'm imagining the way a cat would do these actions, like very calmly and gracefully and elegantly and like indifferently, nonchalantly. And I imagine Crookshanks doing all these things and basically just saving the whole situation while, you know, licking his own paws, right? Like I could be anywhere else right now, but I guess I'll be here on top of Sirius Black. And by the way, save the world eventually by doing it, right? So Crookshanks has my blessing this week.
Oh, I love that. I want to bless Harry. He's just such a good kid. He takes that pause, which is really interesting. Actually, it mirrors the scene in book 6 with Draco and Dumbledore in a really interesting way. But just the like clarity of his sense of betrayal with Sirius, the clarity of we're going to follow Ron. Like, this is just someone who really knows himself and his priorities and is always willing to live up to his values. And I wish I was half as brave as someone like Harry.
I think it's a great blessing, Vanessa. And I think there's also something really touching that when Lupin comes into the room and disarms him, he thinks that he has failed, right?
Yeah.
And there's a poignancy there, which is like, actually, you didn't. Actually, you succeeded. Like, some deeper part of your heart won, even though in the moment, consciously, you think you failed. I mean, it's a really sweet moment.
Yeah. Well, next week, Matt, we are reading chapter 18, Moony, Wormtail, Padfoot, and Prongs. And we wanted to talk about friendship. So you'll be telling a story in the theme of friendship.
Can't wait. Before we close this week, we're going to listen to a testimonial from Julianne, who has been a patron of this podcast for 2 years.
Hey all, my name is Julianne, and I became a patron with Harry Potter and the Sacred Text maybe about 2 years ago. I joined as a patron because I believe so much in the work that they are doing. The podcast is a wonderful place to listen every week and get to explore texts in a different way than I ever have before. It's also filled with a wonderful community of people who want to listen and understand and grow with one another. So if you haven't joined, you should come join us and enjoy the community together.
Everyone, our only announcement this week is please go and support us on Patreon. If you join us in June of 2022, you will get a sticker sent to you. And my mom is going to be the person who mails it to you. So it's just very cute all around. So go to patreon.com/Harry Potter Sacred Text and join our amazing Patreon.
And it's not just the stickers. If we make our goal of 300 new patrons in the month of June, you and I will do a Zoom Q&A with all of our patrons, have a Q&A with them, and it'll be a lot of fun, and we can't wait.
This was a Not Sorry production. We are a feminist production company. Our executive producer is Ariana Nettleman, and we are edited and produced by AJ Yaramas. Our engineer is Erica Wong, and our music is Ivan Paisau and Nick Bull. We are distributed by Acast. We want to give a special thank this month to Hannah Rehack, who is managing our Patreon push and is just an all-around wonderful person. We'd like to thank James for his voicemail this week, Laura Glass, Julia Argy, Gabby Iori, Nikki Zoltan, Casper Turkyle, Stephanie Paulsell, and everyone who sent in the names of their loved ones.
Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I never thought... Okay. Okay, sorry. So this is... Yeah, episode. Oh, I already started recording. Sorry. I'll stop and start again.